This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. As director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, Spencer Crewe has helped change the portrayal of America's past, shifting the emphasis from objects to people, highlighting America's diversity and richness. On October 20, 1998, he spoke at the Knott Memorial at Union College in Schenectady, New York. The following is excerpted from his talk.
Everyone has a worry about how they, or issues they care about, are seen and presented and interpreted in museums. I think their acceptance or resistance to these presentations has a lot to do with their memories and how they understand things should be presented, or what is the proper point of view according to them about a particular issue or a particular set of ideas. Now, if that presentation within the museum is in the way that they remember, then it's fine, and there's no struggle about that story or their presentation, the perspective on history that one receives. However, if that presentation runs counter to their way of remembering things, their understanding of that history, then suddenly it becomes very problematic. And I think it is their memories then that shape how our visitors to museums think about an exhibition or a public presentation, and whether they see it as either wonderful and the best thing they've ever been to see, or dreadful and the worst interpretation that they've ever seen. And we want to avoid the second reaction to our exhibitions as much as possible. This reality creates, I think, a number of challenges for museums. It makes it very important that we move very carefully as we craft public presentations. What we need to do, and we're beginning to do a little bit more, I think, is to keep in mind who are our audiences and how might they respond to what we are doing, and how do we want them to respond to what we are presenting to them. We can't assume that they're going to love what we're doing. We have to think through what's the possible set of responses that one could have to this presentation. I think this comes from the fact that audiences coming to museums are becoming increasingly diverse in nature. And all of them, each and every one of them, are looking to see themselves reflected in the histories that are presented in our museums. They want to see their place as contributors in the growth of this country and in the development of the nation, and they want to make sure that they are part of that story. I think this is a very good thing, but it is something that we have to be very sensitive to in museums because it has pluses and minuses connected with it. I think we have to keep in mind this issue of the diversity of our visitors and realize that it goes beyond often the way we typically tend to define diversity in this country. It's not only about the issues of race and ethnicity, but it also includes the issues of gender, economic standing, your work specialization, your disabilities, your geographic location, and a wide range of other characteristics. What I like to say, and we like to say when we talk around our museum, is that all of us belong to a variety of communities simultaneously. You're not just one person. You're not just a female. You're not just a student at Union College. There are a lot of aspects to your life that help shape who you are. And I think that diversity is part of what we have to think about in our museum. Let me give you a good example of how one has to be aware of these things. At the National Museum of American History, we've been criticized on occasion by the fact that we do not do enough exhibitions that are focused on issues that go west of the Mississippi, that we tend to have an East Coast bias. Well, that's probably right because most of us are from the East Coast and we're comfortable with that. But for those of the members of our staff or our visitors who come from the West, their complaint is they don't see enough in our presentations that speak to the histories that they were taught and the memories they have about the development of the country on the other side of that large river. I think as a consequence, their regional history and remembrances are much different from our own. I think what this does is to highlight the importance of knowing who are your visitors and the need for sensitivity about our audiences in crafting our activities for them. In the instance of the National Museum of American History, where I work, it is knowing that about 60% or more of our visitors come from outside the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, so that we have to think about what are the experiences that they bring and how they might want, what they might want to see in our presentations. It also means that we have to keep in mind the kind of experiences and perspectives that they will bring to our museum as visitors when they come to see us, and what kind of knowledge they hope to gain. For example, we have to assume that there are people who come who have no knowledge of the general history of the United States, because a goodly proportion of our visitors are from foreign countries. So we want to make sure that in our presentations we give them some sense of the history of the country in a general sense. That is why I think thinking about this issue of memory is such an important concept for those of us who work in museums. Because in some ways, I think, personal experiences and memory can run very counter to the way that historians usually tend to operate and to approach their work. And let me sort of point out to you why I believe this is very much the case. Let's first of all start with the definition of memory. And it's, I think, a very interesting concept when you really stop and think about it. Essentially, you can define memory as a power that deliberately arranges experiences and tends to exclude what it does not find useful or appropriate. We were talking about that over dinner. So is that right, Bob? Okay, works for it, right. I think it agrees with what we were talking about. And I think it also can be very selective in nature, and it's not always objective or accurate in what it recounts as part of that memory. I think what memory can do is to reshape events to suit a particular perspective, or to exclude painful or unhappy experiences in one's life. Or it can unduly highlight an event that one has experienced in a very positive way. Now, I think that's why people's memories of the same events can differ dramatically, because they see it from a different perspective or remember it in a very different way. Now, historical research in the ideal state, because I'm sure there are variations from the ideal to the real state, has a somewhat different orientation, I believe. The task of historians is to collect all past historical data and to craft a thoughtful overview of these activities. So what it'll do is to take in all these different memories from different perspectives and begin to see what is the overview, the larger perspective, that one can bring to it. And a historian doing their analysis does not leave out the unpleasant facts in this analysis. It also does not always wind up with a happy ending. It's not a Grimm's fairy tale. It can have a very negative ending. And it can bring to the surface, I think, facts or moments in people's existence that people would rather exclude or forget about as not being the kind of thing that they want to remember themselves by. This, I think, can create a circumstance which can cause discomfort or anger for people who have a different set of memories or different set of perspectives about this. Especially this is the case in the kinds of public presentations that we provide in museums. For a public historian in particular, this can create a very difficult dilemma at a minimum, or in the worst instance, it can create a controversy that can overwhelm you and sometimes destroy you. You can point to several kind of examples of this kind of circumstance coming to the surface. For example, there was the exhibition about the Irish that the New York Historical Society wanted to put together, and the controversy that arose about that. Or at our own institution, the Enola Gay exhibition about the bombing of Hiroshima during World War II. I should point out that was not in my museum, that was at the Air and Space Museum. But it is still a controversy that had a great impact upon us. Or there was the wonderful Sigmund Freud exhibition at the Library of Congress, where the disagreements about interpreting Freud and his way of looking at the world became very controversial. I think for those of us who create and are involved in public presentations, these exhibitions really illustrate why we need to be acutely aware of our audiences and how we position our work relative to them and their thought processes. Now, I'm not advocating here before you that as scholars we should give up our scholarship or the quality of our research. But I think it does say that we need to think about the nature of our relationship to our audiences and how we want to forge a partnership or connection between our work and their expectations and their, look at these things. What is critical, I think, is how we present this information for consumption. And I think we have to think about the kind of expectation we want to have about their coming to our institutions, so that we have thought through what we want them to take out of that experience when they come to visit us. What we cannot assume, which we've done in the past and are beginning to look at differently, is that visitors will come and will passively accept what we present to them, but instead that they will come and they will challenge the work that we do, and they will try to provide alternative views and information in ways that sometimes they find useful or sometimes that we find useful. So this back and forth, I think, is an important aspect of the museum experience that we have to think about more clearly in our museums and in our exhibitions. I think this issue probably creates the biggest challenges facing history museums as well as museums in general today. The question of the nature of our relationship to our audiences. Essentially, what we're struggling with is what it means to be an audience-focused museum or institution. This is an idea that the business community for a very long time has been struggling with and have been worried about, because if they don't think about their audience slash customers, they aren't successful, they go under. And I think for museums, this is an idea that's become more and more of relevance to them about very lately. But it's something we've come to very reluctantly. When I was talking with the students this afternoon, I was saying that at our museum, American History Museum, we don't charge a fee to come into the museum to look at our exhibitions. So it's sort of a reach to have a great concern about audiences, because if more come in, we don't make more money necessarily, and if fewer come in, we don't lose money. So having an audience orientation really doesn't have a very pragmatic effect upon us on a day-to-day basis. But it does say that it's really important to think about the nature of your presentations and how you do that, because those people are important. And there could be the fact that you alienate enough people, in particular your larger audience, Congress, that it can work to your detriment. So being audience focused is an important transition for us to make. And also I think it's important for us to think about providing an experience that has value to our visitors, as defined, I think, by both parties. It has to be a negotiation between museums and the people who come to see their exhibitions. Different museums, I think, are beginning to respond to this issue in different kinds of ways, and are looking at this challenge as something important for them to engage with. Most, I think, are reorienting themselves fairly successfully to this audience-focused approach. And they are consciously thinking about who are their primary audiences overall, and who are the audiences specifically that they want to address in particular exhibitions. Let me tell you what I mean. I think a lot of museums now are beginning to look at what is the profile of their visitors to the museum. What is the makeup? For example, what are the ages of the people who come to their museum? What is their income level? And what is their education level? And who make up the core of your visitors? Knowing that helps you to figure out how you want to orient your exhibitions. Also knowing that lets you know who's not coming and who you'd like to bring into your museum to become part of that visitorship on a regular basis, and what you need to do to maintain your base and to expand it in ways that you find successful. I think to do this, there are a couple of key issues that all history museums need to consider as they engage with their audiences in creative kinds of ways. One issue is that they need to get their visitors to better understand what history is. They need to get their visitors to better understand what history is, and I'll talk a bit more about that. The second issue is they need to get their visitors to accept the concept that part of the educational process is engaging in ideas of all types, sometimes even ideas that you don't agree with, that the conversation is a very useful part of the educational process. Now, earlier I offered a quick definition of how historians go about doing their work, but did not talk about what, in essence, that task is. I think that task is in part to provide a better understanding of the past through their research. That our task is to really give people a better perspective on the past itself. And the challenge, I think, in doing this is that the general public really seems to believe that our understanding, the understanding of the past, is a very static thing, that the past never changes, that what you learn in high school or what you learn in college is history as it should be, and it stops just like that and never changes. It's a very static thing. And that the facts they learned when they were in high school are the facts that are for all time and for all people. The reality, though, I believe, for history is that our understanding of the past is constantly changing. And as new information comes to light, as a result of new research and new discoveries, that history keeps changing. That as we find new bodies of information, it changes. That as new scholarship comes to the forefront in terms of looking at people who had not been looked at before, our sense of history changes. As we find new sources of information, it continues to change in important kind of ways. I think that the wonderful aspect of recognizing the diversity of our audiences is that it also opens up new sources of information for exploration in our presentations. As new people are coming in the door, it means there's new topics that we can talk about, new issues that we can offer to them. What this does is to give them a sense of place in history, but also offer up new perspectives to all kind of visitors who come to our museums. I think the challenge with these new opportunities is that everyone is not always happy with what this new information offers or presents about American history. What it may do is to depict these certain individuals in a way that they do not like, or in a way that they were not taught when they were younger. This can be very disconcerting or jolting to many people, and I think it can cause a very negative reaction. For example, let's think about the Battle of Little Bighorn. Now, way back when I was in high school, it was seen as this terrible massacre that happened to these Union soldiers in the West. Well, as we've learned more information and have added new perspective, if you are a Native American, it's seen as a great victory for your cause after years and years of mistreatment. Well, both stories are true, but it becomes an interesting issue of presentation in museums to think about how you present that and how you do it in a way that doesn't cause a huge struggle or catastrophe for the museum itself. And I think this is the struggle that we face in museums in terms of presentation and how we interact with our audiences. In Washington, D.C., they tend to talk about these new pieces of information that come out about history as revisionist history. That is, they are saying that the history presented in our museums very often has been rewritten in a negative fashion and does not represent the truth of history, or at least the truth as they remember it. In one sense, I think they are right. This is revisionist history, but not in the negative way that is implied by how they refer to it. I think our sense of the past is constantly changing as a result of research, new research that is taking place. And I think this is a good thing. It can't stay the same because it's not always the same. New things have come to the surface. Now, if we were to take this same concept and apply it to science, that is, new research, new ideas, you would be seen as an individual creating great new breakthroughs in science and really advancing mankind through the discoveries that you are making. But we haven't quite made this transition of this same definition to history. Right now, new ideas represent revisionism and overturning of the past and talking about the United States maybe in a negative way. What we need to do is have our audiences more and more accept the idea that history is constantly changing and that we have to see history research as a dynamic process and one that everybody needs to feel comfortable with and are open to within our museums and within conversations about history itself. My hope is to be able to go to conversations with reporters and not have them say to me, well, tell me what is the history about this particular issue or the history about this particular idea, because there is not one the history, but there are nuances and various forms of analysis I think that help provide an understanding for these issues. Now, how we can do this to provide the sense of a dynamic nature of history is one of the challenges that we face in history museums. And I think we have to be a little bit more direct about this question in our presentations. What we have to do is to be able to tell our visitors what it is we are doing and why we are taking that perspective or that approach in the presentation that we are offering to them. And try to get them to think about this in new ways. And this is one of the challenges I think we faced pretty dramatically at the National Museum of American History. And we have tried to think about this in a very proactive way over the last several years. And I want to sort of give you a case study of that approach as an example of how I think we can begin to cope with these ideas. You may all have heard about, or maybe not, that not that long ago, we opened an exhibition on sweatshops. And the title of the exhibition is Between a Rock and a Hard Place, A History of Sweatshops from 1820 to the Present. Now, the heart of that show sprang out of a raid that took place in El Monte, California, of a sweatshop in that city. The raid took place in August of 1995, in which Thai workers were being held essentially as slaves behind barbed wire fences and forced to sew and produce apparel for use in stores all across the country. Clearly, this is not a good thing. And one of the things we did once that raid took place was to collect some of that material and bring it back to the museum. The reason we did that is that we had been involved in a long-term study of work and workers in the history of this country, and we thought this is a really critical moment and a critical event for us to focus our attention on. Well, what happened was that this exhibition, as we talked about doing it, generated great opposition from the very start, especially from parts of the apparel industry. They felt that we were going to hold them up to negative criticism, and that we were focusing on the worst aspects of the industry, and these were not really representative of how the apparel industry, the garment trades, were operating in this present day. Their feeling was that if we were to do an exhibition like this, we would give them a negative image in the mind of the public, and perhaps we would, more importantly, hurt their profits. Now, what they said very strongly, in addition to that it was not our role as the National Museum of American History to talk about these kinds of issues, which looked at the negative aspects of the country. We were supposed to be a place that celebrates America, that celebrates American activities and American accomplishments, and we really should not look at the negative side of American life. Well, clearly, we felt very differently about that and about our role and what we should be doing as a national museum. We felt, in part, it was an aspect of our overall mission to include exhibitions like this as part of the variety of exhibitions we did within the museum, and that we should have some things that celebrated the history of this country and the accomplishments, but other things that talked about some of the difficulties that we had faced. That one of the things that we learn from is our mistakes, and by highlighting those mistakes, there's a learning process that can take place that will benefit people in the long run. So in crafting the exhibition, there were several points we tried to make knowing that this struggle was going to be before us. The first point that we addressed very directly was to put a label in the very front of the exhibition that stated why it was important for a history museum to create an exhibition like this one. And in essence, what we said were several things. First of all, that we believe that the history of this country was a very complex and complicated experience to unravel, and that it was important to acknowledge both the heroic aspects of American life as well as the tragic aspects of our history, that all is part of what we'd experienced as a nation, and that we felt that by doing this, you stimulated a much more sophisticated understanding of our past, and we felt that it would make our visitors much more sophisticated connoisseurs of history, and better understand what has gone into the making of this nation and has brought us to the point we are today. And we believe that our visitors really wanted this kind of exposure in the exhibitions that we did. We took this approach because, first of all, we thought it was important, and we still believe it's important, that you need to tell visitors up front what you're trying to accomplish. That way you sort of disarm them so they don't go in and expect one set of ideas to come to the surface or one set of approaches and find another, but in fact you're saying, here's what we plan to do and this is why we're going to do it. And we didn't want to leave it up to them to just guess our reasons for doing the exhibition. More importantly, we did this because we did not want to allow our opponents to control the conversation. That by saying this is why we were doing this, that this sort of took some of their fire from their arguments against it. In the exhibition itself, we took some other steps, I think, to help lessen that kind of opposition. We wrote labels that were very straightforward and clear and very historically accurate. We tried to leave out the editorializing in our presentation so that we weren't offering a perspective so much as here's the information connected with it. We also tried to avoid making judgments in those labels, but instead to convey the historical facts. And we also put a strong emphasis in the exhibition on historical context, that we didn't just feature the Almonte sweatshop as the centerpiece of the exhibition, but really gave a historical overlay to the history of sweatshops and how this particular incident fit into a long history of garment trade, garment work, and sweatshops in the history of this country. In fact, one of the things we pointed out was the historical origins of the word sweatshop and how they've been a part of the labor and business history of this country for a very long time. We also have then pointed out how the growth of a global economy has made this whole issue of sweatshops a very complicated issue, In other words, it's not very simple to point fingers at one place or another, but really there's lots of things that go into this. The idea was to point out the richness and the complexity of this issue and the struggles faced by all parties in trying to deal with something that I think we all agree is a negative part of the garment industry's trade and activities. As I said, the main point of all this was to point out the complexity of this historical issue and this historical experience. I think the final step we took, which was new in our exhibition to add to this sense of the complexity of historical moments and historical issues, was to create in the last part of the exhibition a section in which we allowed different groups to talk about their perspective on sweatshops. What we did was to allow six different groups, 500 words, to say what they thought the public ought to know about sweatshops. And they were a wide range of individuals. They ranged from the community leader who represented the Thai workers at El Monte. They also included people from the retail industry, a labor leader from Unite, and Kathy Lee Gifford. And we also have showmen. We want to get them in the door. But each one offered a slightly different perspective about sweatshops and what we should know about it. And then for the final step, we put notebooks in the exhibition space at the very end and asked the visitors to write their thoughts about sweatshops and what we ought to do or not do about them and how they fit into the context of American history. I think you'd find it very interesting to read those responses because we had the whole range of responses from those who thought that sweatshops were abominable to those who think they were just a part of life and you have to live with them. And there were very lively exchanges back and forth within the notebooks among the readers of those notebooks as they looked at one another's opinions. I think this, for us, has been a way of beginning to position ourselves to talk about controversial topics in a way that allows us to make this a part of our presentation, I'd say, menu for our visitors. And we think this approach to creating a rock and a hard place has been a very different one, an exciting one for our museum, and helps us to begin to think about the future. It has allowed us to make a presentation on a controversial issue successfully, I would say. It's been up now since the summer of 1998 and will run until November of this year. And we've actually survived it, and Congress has not shut us down, at least as of this morning. So I think we're okay. And I think more importantly, what this exhibition has done, though, is it has further reinforced what we believe is the educational role of museums with respect to their visitors. That what this does is to help visitors understand that they can look at topics and find different interpretations within them, and that is okay. And to realize that there is not just one absolute truth about historical subjects, but there are many different facts and ways of interpreting and understanding these issues. And I think and that is the case also in doing history research and writing in general, that it is taking together lots of different pieces of information and fitting them together in ways that make sense to that interpreter. And that interpretation may vary depending upon who that individual is. Certainly it's something that all of us learn in graduate school and graduate seminars, that there's more than one way to look at historical issues. What we also hope, though, comes out of this exhibition is that it will help reinforce the overall educational mission of our museum and of museums in general. That it will serve as a teaching tool to suggest to visitors that the museum is not the final voice of authority in our presentations, but that there are often other perspectives which are also valid. I think these points of view can originate from the scholars who do the work on the exhibition itself. It can come from other knowledgeable sources who aren't scholars directly, and it can also originate from the experiences of the visitors themselves. All these are valid perspectives that can come to play in our exhibitions. I think the reality is that museums should be a place where ideas are able to interact among themselves and where conversations can take place among the people within that space and where one can wrestle with new ideas safely. And I think if we lose that ability to have a wrestling of ideas safely, museums no longer can serve the kind of purpose I think they need to save. But I think this is a very extremely important and difficult concept to convey to our visitors. It is not the way I think they tend to think about museums in general at this point. If we are successful, I believe, in transitioning the thought process of our visitors about what museums are and can do, we will have turned a very important corner. We will have an agreement that the free and open exchange of ideas within a museum is an appropriate thing to have happen within its walls, and that museums are providing a very important service to the people who come to see our exhibitions and our programs. A service that is different from a baseball game, or from a movie, or from going to the opera. But it's actually unique in its own way and valuable in its own way. But certainly I think it is worth seeking out and taking advantage of what insights and experiences that museums can offer to our visitors. What it can do is to allow them to see the world from a different vantage point and to better understand the complexity of the world in which they live and the issues that swirl about them every day in their lives. And I think if that experience doesn't make them a better person, it can certainly make them a more thoughtful person. And that, I don't think, is bad. To be a thoughtful person, a critically thinking person, is a good thing. And I think that is the proper role of an educational institution. Now, I tend to be a very pragmatic person, and I'm very pragmatic about what I believe is the impact that museums can have upon individuals and upon visitors to our institutions. I do not believe that museums can change society in and of themselves, or that our exhibitions will change society, or have any kind of a cataclysmic impact upon people. What I do believe, though, is that they can make people more thoughtful and better critical thinkers. And if we can do that in our presentations in museums, we can make an important contribution to society and to the people who use us. And this goes back to where I began this conversation, that I think it's important for us as museums to think very carefully and often about our visitors and to provide them with a valuable product in a form that they can find interesting and educational. This is a formula that's very easily described, but I think it's one that's very difficult to deliver to those people who come to our museums. I believe we've begun to do this in certain ways in the sweatshop exhibition at our museum and at other exhibitions and other museums across the country. And we plan to use those lessons that we've learned from these experiences and other exhibitions that we will do in the future. However, there are really no guarantees to this approach, and no guarantees that it will work well in the next exhibition that you do, because each one is a new experience, a new set of challenges. So there are no foolproof formulas that we can put in place that will ensure that we'll have success and we'll get into trouble in the next exhibition. But that's why I find working in museums exciting and really sort of very fulfilling, because it is sort of walking on the edge regularly and allowing the quality of the research, the quality of the scholarship, to really guide how you think about exhibitions, and then to figure out how do you position them in the best possible way, and to help to avoid controversy when you know it's around the corner. I think the most important thing we can do in this equation is to try to keep our audiences in mind and to try to create a product that is both engaging and educational. If we do that, I think we will be on the right road and we'll be fulfilling at least our mission at the National Museum of American History, which in part says that we are dedicated to stimulating imaginations and creating learning opportunities for our visitors. And if we continue to create the learning opportunities, I think we will continue to have success and we'll be able to fight this issue of controversy and concern with our visitors in a much more positive and a useful fashion. Thank you.
Was Spencer Crew, the director of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. He spoke on October 20th, 1998, at Union College in Schenectady, New York. You're listening to Talking History. Our next segment comes from the Creighton University Production Center of Talking History. Your host will be Brian LeBeau, chair of the Department of History of Creighton University.
In a few minutes, we will explore the origins and history of Thanksgiving with Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon, and get the opinion of members of the United American Indians of New England on our Thanksgiving holiday. But before we do that, let's look back at this week in history. The major event of this week in history occurred on November 29, 1947. Its history, however, begins nearly a century earlier, when Jews from around the world began a push, known as the Zionist Movement, to establish a national homeland. Their efforts went largely unheeded until Nazi persecution of the Jews created a sense of urgency. Then, on November 29, 1947, the United Nations voted to partition Palestine into separate Jewish and Arab sectors. The vote was opposed by neighboring Arab countries, and when, in 1948, the State of Israel was proclaimed, its Arab neighbors declared war. The rest is history. Turning to this week's History in the News, 12-year-old Hunter Scott of Pensacola, Florida, recently attracted the attention of historians and the U.S. Congress by reevaluating the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history. His seventh-grade history project brought new evidence and a fresh interpretation to the torpedoed fate of the USS Indianapolis that sank in July of 1946. From the initial court-martial of the ship's captain, the Navy has maintained that Rear Admiral Charles B. McVeigh III was to blame for the incident that took the lives of 881 sailors. According to Scott, however, McVeigh had no way of knowing he was putting his crew at risk. Congress now plans to pardon McVeigh and honor the memory of the USS Indianapolis and her crew. And Millennium Fever is incubating in the most unlikely of victims, historians. As the end of the decade, century, and millennium draw near, historians are distressed over just how to label and understand the recent past. A frantic competition to definitively name the 90s and thus close 100 years of American history has begun. Should the 90s be the information age, the age of genetic engineering, the age of political scandal, or the age of the soaring stock market? Whatever it is they decide, this final decade of the 20th century will no doubt reflect the rapid change that has dominated the last 100 years of American history. You're listening to Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History. For the principal segment of our Thanksgiving show, I'm pleased to welcome Matthew Dennis, Professor of History at the University of Oregon. Professor Dennis is the author of Cultivating a Landscape of Peace, Iroquois European Encounters in 17th Century America. He is currently working on a book on the cultural history of the public holidays in the United States titled Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, Identity, Memory, and the American Character. Welcome, Professor Dennis.
Hi, Brian.
Thanks for joining us. Let me start off with something that you included in the material you sent me about your forthcoming book, in which you said that the national Thanksgiving festival that we know today, the contemporary festival, is really a 19th century or Victorian invention. Now, that's news to some of us who thought really it dated to 1621. What do you mean by that?
Well, we can date, you know, the first Thanksgiving to 1621, in a sense. But the reason we do that is really because certain reformers, especially in the 19th century, wanted to gesture back to that event in order to do certain things in the present. So, in that way, we really see the Thanksgiving that we know today emerge in a later time. But again, gesturing to an earlier time in the 17th century.
Is it? Go ahead.
Well, the past it doesn't necessarily tell us anything unless we ask. And people like Sarah Josepha Hale, a woman editor and reformer of the early 19th century, was trying to figure out what was going on in 19th century America. It was a time of great turmoil. Mm. Industrialization was beginning to emerge as and change the face of American society and geography, and immigration was beginning to pick up.
How does all this come together in declaring a national holiday, though?
Well, what happened, I think, was that Sarah Josepha Hale and others drew from what they thought was a purer, a simpler, and nobler past. Hmm. Their experience in New England. She came herself from New Hampshire. And they looked for, this wasn't a cynical thing, but I think that what really popped out to them were these figures from the past who represented a certain piety and purity and earnestness, values on hard work. And And they found the pilgrims as those kinds of heroes. Mm. And they found a way to then celebrate them at Thanksgiving.
Is this connected with the traditional New England holiday called Forefathers Day?
Well, that's what happened was there was a kind of competition in a sense. Both of those, there was a celebration that was really confined to New England, in which the New Englanders celebrated the landing of the Pilgrims in 1620, and that was really a holiday confined just to locals, and it would be celebrated in December rather than in November as traditional Thanksgiving. It was in many ways a kind of male holiday. It was usually celebrated by men's clubs over banquets and feasts, and women really had a secondary role. But increasingly, Thanksgiving became more and more important as a kind of tamer, domesticated version of that holiday, and one that celebrated domesticity, abundance, and the harvest, rather than that founding event, the landing at the landing at Plymouth Rock, if that in fact ever happened.
So that emphasis on domesticity is what you meant by Victorian, then?
Well, yeah, it's a reformist holiday in that it tried to curb some of the unruly tendencies that were perceived to be about in 19th century society. Mm-hmm. So it brought the holiday from out of doors into people's homes. Mm. It made it from a kind of a boisterous male holiday into one that was feminized and controlled by by women, even in a patriarchal household, and it's one that was much calmer and more sedate, more controlled, which fit well with some of the values that middle class reformers in the 19th century were trying to encourage in the society.
Now, the date usually used for the first national holiday, if you will, is 1863. Why that date, and why would that be important for us to know?
Well, the first national celebration came in 1863, as you said, with a proclamation by Abraham Lincoln. Now, of course, that's right in the middle of the Civil War. And what was particularly important about that was that it seemed to be a way that the nation could attempt to bind itself together, at least in the view of someone like Abraham Lincoln and others who encouraged him. The nation was completely torn asunder, and what he and others thought might be possible would be to look back to a more distant, less problematic past, where people throughout America could identify with a common set of ancestors and a common historical event. So, at the worst possible moment in American history, that seemed to be an event that might be able to begin the process of healing. And that's certainly something that Sarah Josepha Hale was trying to promote as well.
Mm-hmm. Would the fact that it came during the Civil War connect at all with the selection of a New England event as a national holiday?
Well, that's interesting, because the New England has been at the center of American culture and cultural production, from the very beginning. And in a way, that was problematic, because sometimes the New England-based holiday of Thanksgiving was associated, or had been associated, with abolitionism, which made it, incredibly unpopular in the South, and in some cases, Southern governors would refuse to proclaim Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So, in some ways, in the Civil War, or following the Civil War, that association with New England could be as much a liability as anything else.
Okay.
But Sarah Josepha Hale herself tried very hard, even before the Civil War, to talk about the holiday as national and not regional. In her novel Northwood, she said, quite specifically, this is a tale. She lays out the kind of classic classic Thanksgiving celebration, and in it she says that this is something for everyone. This is a holiday, and this is a nation that should know no north or south.
Well, Lincoln's intentions notwithstanding in Hale's comments, then there's still an element of politics in this, and yet, again, in the material that you sent me for your new book, you say that Thanksgiving has seen its share of political contention, but less today than in the past. How is this the case, that politics was once involved and is no longer there?
Well, it's, you know, politics is always around in American life, but it is... certainly striking. It was striking to me and surprising that holiday has become much less political in a sense than it used to be. In the early history of the Republic, and even before in the colonial period, Thanksgivings were not regular events. They weren't celebrated every year. They were only declared for particular occasions to celebrate particularly beneficial events. And so what happened was that they were associated with things that could themselves be controversial. So there could be an argument about whether something should be celebrated in a Thanksgiving, or it should be mourned and commemorated with a day of fasting and humiliation. And so what this did was politicize the holiday if there was not consensus within the society. Lincoln's use of it was, in a way, a kind of politics to end all politics, to take the politics out of it, which, you know, of course, he was privileged to do, ultimately, as the victor, the president of the winning side in the Civil War. But then I think Americans, after the Civil War, in an effort to reconcile, invested Thanksgiving with a kind of nonpartisanism. And so what happened then in the late 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt tried to move the traditional date of Thanksgiving, it generated all sorts of antagonism. People were just up in arms that he was moving it from the last Thursday in November to the third Thursday in November. Of course, his reasoning was that he wanted to extend the Christmas shopping season and help Americans try to perhaps spend their way out of the Depression.
How was that resolved?
Well, for a couple of years, there was a good deal of controversy from 1939 or so to 1941, when Roosevelt would often declare one day Thanksgiving, individual governors would declare another day, and so, for example, in 1931, some 22 or 23 states celebrated it on one day. Some 22 or 23 celebrated it on another day a week later, and two states, Texas and Colorado, celebrated it twice. They couldn't move the date conveniently, especially in a state like Texas, because the big football game pitting, I think, Texas against Texas A&M was scheduled for the original date of Thanksgiving, and to undermine the ceremony and the importance of that game by moving it off of Thanksgiving was just unthinkable, so they just had to do it twice. Well,
for a couple of years, then, it was worth living in Texas. You got two Thanksgivings and a football game out of it.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. Well, another surprising comment you make, moving away from politics, is that you write that the Thanksgiving holiday has actually become less commercialized over the years. Again, that would surprise most people who think everything is becoming more commercialized.
Yeah, I think that's true, actually. And what I argue in the chapter is that Thanksgiving, in a sense, inoculates us against the crass commercialism of the Christmas season. Thanksgiving is traditionally the day, or the day after Thanksgiving is the day when shopping begins and when the whole Christmas blitz begins to really pick up steam. I think Americans really see Thanksgiving often as a kind of haven in a relentless calendar. And it's a time where we don't focus on a vast amount of consumption in the marketplace. We're not out and about. We're at home. We're sharing a meal. We're not buying gifts for each other or feel that kind of pressure, but instead we get together. We try to, understand who we are, how we're situated in families and communities, and so in a way it keeps us it gives us a bit of a relief from the commercialization of the calendar that is so obvious during Christmas. Something like the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, for example, is really not about Thanksgiving. It's about Christmas. Mm-hmm. Santa Claus goes through, and really it begins that entire commercial blitz. And you know, Macy's is obviously behind that, and hopes to benefit by having a lot of shoppers come through its doors. But it's a day. It's an event, that kind of parade, and others in other cities around the country. It's the kind of event that is on Thanksgiving, but not of Thanksgiving.
Yeah, let me pick up that on just a bit, because I think one of the nicest passages in what you wrote, and I hope you'll keep, in your book relates to that theme, where you say, on Thanksgiving, without fanfare or manifestos, Americans collectively shape the meaning of the occasion and the meaning of America itself, and declare their national identity simply by convening privately and voluntarily and eating turkey. I think it's a wonderful passage.
Thanks. I think that it's, I think one of the things that makes Thanksgiving so special is that it's a public and political event. It's a time when we declare our identity as Americans, but we do it in private. And so there's a lot of different ways of accomplishing that goal. We don't have any national referential event. It just happens in our houses and around the turkey. We can celebrate it in various sorts of ways, depending on what sort of ethnicity or culture we come from. So it's a way of being, in a sense, public, privately, acting religiously but in a non-sectarian way, and celebrating some of the better values of American society: reciprocity, diversity, inclusiveness, generosity, and so forth.
Well, we can't let you off on such a high note, because as you heard in my introduction, we're going to be talking to, or we're hearing from, two Native Americans on Thanksgiving. How do they fit into this idea of yours about diversity and toleration on Thanksgiving?
In the most complicated way possible, I'm sure. And I think that's a good balance. It is the case, and this is certainly something that I emphasize in my work as well, that Thanksgivings have been celebrated for nefarious as well as beneficial events. In early New England, on a number of occasions, Thanksgivings were celebrated to celebrate the defeat of Indian allies or Indian enemies, in some cases, after really devastating massacres. And so, I think that is clearly something to be reckoned with. Thanksgiving's not like Columbus Day, though. I don't think it celebrates conquerors. What it celebrates is the possibility that people actually get along. In some ways, it celebrates the road not fully taken after 1621. For years and years, for a generation, Pilgrims and Wampanoags and other New England Indians were able to get along pretty well. That ultimately broke down. And, you know, we know about the tragic history and the really reprehensible history of the ways that Native people on this continent were treated by colonists and expansionists, settlers in the West.
Great.
But there's always the promise that, in fact, there are other possibilities, and that those possibilities are celebrated in that first Thanksgiving in 1621.
Well, thanks. Well put, and that's the note we will end on, because we're out of time. So thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And happy Thanksgiving.
And same to you.
Great.
You've been listening to Matthew Dennis, professor of history at the University of Oregon and author of the forthcoming book, Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, Identity, Memory, and the American Calendar, to be published by Cornell University Press. There are two sides to most stories, even for those stories we recall during our national holidays. For most of us, for example, Thanksgiving is a day of celebration. For others, however, it's a day of mourning. Here to offer that perspective on Thanksgiving are Matoi Monroe and Munanam James, members of the United American Indians of New England. The UAINE has protested the annual Thanksgiving holiday by holding a national day of mourning on Thanksgiving for the past 28 years.
Every year since 1970, hundreds of Native Americans and our supporters have gathered at noon on Coles Hill in Plymouth, Massachusetts on Thanksgiving Day to observe a national day of mourning. Instead of celebrating Thanksgiving, we mourn our Native forebears, who were sold into slavery, burned alive, and massacred since the arrival of the Europeans. Thanksgiving in the United States is much more than a harvest festival. It is a celebration of the Pilgrim mythology. According to that mythology, the Pilgrims arrived, the Native people fed and welcomed them, and everyone lived happily ever after. The truth is a sharp contrast to that mythology.
The Pilgrims did not find an empty land any more than Columbus discovered anything. One of the first things the Pilgrims did when they arrived on Cape Cod, before they even made it to Plymouth, was to rob Wampanoag graves at Corn Hill and steal as much of the Indians' winter provisions of corn and beans as they were able to carry. The Pilgrims were no better than any other group of European invaders when it came to their treatment of the indigenous peoples here. And no, they did not even land at that sacred shrine called Plymouth Rock, which to us is a monument to racism and oppression. The first official day of Thanksgiving was proclaimed in 1637 to celebrate the safe return of men from the Massachusetts Bay Colony who had gone to Mystic, Connecticut to participate in the massacre of more than 700 Pequot Indians.
About the only true thing in the whole mythology is that these pitiful European strangers would not have survived their first several years were it not for the aid of Wampanoag people. What Native people received in return for this help was genocide, theft of our lands, and never-ending repression. We are subject to brutal racism or treated as quaint relics from the past. When we dare to stand up for our rights, we are considered unreasonable or are attacked.
Can we give thanks as we remember Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who was framed by the FBI and has been falsely imprisoned since 1976? Can we give thanks for the fact that all too many Native people live in the most abysmal poverty? Our life expectancies are much lower, our infant mortality and teen suicide rates much higher than those of white Americans. Racist stereotypes of Native people, such as those perpetuated by the Cleveland Indians and many other sports teams, persist. And every one of the more than 350 treaties that Native nations signed with the U.S. was broken by the government.
Many non-Indian people are now seeking alternatives to such holidays as Columbus Day and Thanksgiving. They are coming to the conclusion that we all must face the truth about the history of this country and the toll that history has taken on the lives of millions of indigenous, black, Latino, Asian, and poor and working class white people. That is why increasing numbers of non-Native people join us for National Day of Mourning.
The myth of Thanksgiving, served up with dollops of European superiority and manifest destiny, just does not work for many of us. As Malcolm X once said about the African-American experience in America, we did not land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. Exactly.
You've been listening to Matoi Monroe and Munanam James, members of the United American Indians of New England.
Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska.